This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Neither party wants to offend the fossil fuel industry. They want to win the election, and they know the power of the fossil fuel industry. You can't turn on your television without seeing these advertisements about clean coal, clean tar sands, and the claim that there's more jobs associated with fossil fuels than with other energies. That's, of course, not true, but they're hammering that into the voters' heads. And so if anyone challenges the fossil fuel industry, first of all, they're going to lose the money that they get from the fossil fuel industry. And secondly, they're going to have the fossil fuel industry against them in the election. The politicians are not willing to say that we cannot burn all the fossil fuels without guaranteeing a different planet and cheating our children.
That was NASA scientist James Hansen speaking on The Young Turks on Current TV. I'm Alex Smith. No matter who was elected in the United States, the fossil fuel companies won. This year, big oil, coal, and gas made more money than anyone in the history of money. And a Supreme Court decision called Citizens United let big corporations spend hundreds of millions to fund politicians. But there was another judgment made recently. In the court of nature, reality has spoken. Deny climate change all the way to the bank, but we will all pay billions, even pay with our lives, as Earth's climate is destabilized. The residents of New York and New Jersey got an ugly taste of the different planet James Hansen has warned us about for the past 25 years. Can we protect New York City from the next big surge of rising seas? What about Washington and Baltimore? What happens to all that expensive real estate with oceanfront views? We'll talk with a scientist about storm surge controls around the world. It will cost tens of billions, but as always, the cost of doing nothing is even more. Of course, we can still prevent the worst by switching to renewable energy. Daphne Weisham brings us a key interview from Germany, where renewables are booming. Hermann Ott is a member of the German Federal Parliament, but even he knows renewables cannot power our current overamped civilization. But first, we're going to hear from a man who wrote the book on the New York storm surge, predicting the whole mess we've just seen in a book published 6 years ago. That's Mike Tidwell. Ah, New York. Let's warm up with Billy Joel's Miami 2017, rewritten for New York after Sandy and performed live at the NBC Red Cross fundraiser November 2nd.
Go out on Broadway. I saw the Empire State a little low. Storm went on beyond the Palisades, out in the Rockaways, the oceans overflowed. We held a concert out in Brooklyn.
Who could have foreseen the amount of damage Hurricane Sandy caused in New York City and New Jersey? Well, Mike Tidwell sure did. A half dozen years ago, Tidwell published his book titled The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. Mike is the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, a grassroots nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness about global warming in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. He's also a filmmaker and an award-winning environmentalist. Mike Tidwell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
so much for having me.
Now, when you published The Ravaging Tide, what did you say could happen to New York City?
You know, anyone who looks at a map and sees the geographic features of New York Harbor and Manhattan is made quickly aware of the fact that if a big surge tide from a hurricane were to enter that New York Harbor and surrounding areas, there's nowhere for the water to go but up. You know, basically New York Harbor and the East River and Hudson River form a kind of catchment for water. And once that water gets in there, literally there's nowhere for it to spread out. There are no vast wetlands, interior wetlands, or flat areas. And the only place for the water to go is up, which is why New York is in many ways a basket case waiting to happen. And when I wrote my book in 2006 after Katrina, you know, many of us concerned about climate change, you know, lifted our gaze to say, well, if this kind of disaster can happen in New Orleans, where else might it happen from, you know, the combination of sea level rise and rising sea surface temperatures that provide the fuel for hurricanes? If a really big hurricane hit elsewhere in the United States, where might the most damage be caused? And New York just, you know, jumped out at me during my research. And that's why I basically, in my 2006 book, described pretty much everything we've seen the last week. In fact, the paperback version of that book, also that came out in 2006, has an illustration of Manhattan with water pouring into it in a really sort of spooky, foreshadowing way. So I guess it just, you know, anyone who's out of denial about climate change and is looking at the real reality of sea level rise and bigger storms, you know, was very clear that New York was vulnerable. And even Mayor Michael Bloomberg was warning about these impacts potentially happening.
And how was your book received? Did people believe it or criticize or just ignore it?
Well, the book was published by Free Press, and it got good reviews, but, you know, there's that whole people not wanting to hear bad news, and change is difficult for people. And I have a friend who's told me, please stop writing books, because in 2003, I wrote another book called Bayou Farewell that predicted the Katrina hurricane disaster. Literally, the subtitle of that 2003 book was The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast, again, published in 2003, 2 years before the Katrina disaster, because that disaster was obvious to anyone paying attention as well, because of the poor levees, the rising ocean levels, the disappearing wetlands and barrier islands. Katrina was a disaster foretold by many journalists and activists like myself for many years before it came. But even in that book was not well received before it came out, warning about a potential Katrina. And the 2006 book, The Ravaging Tide, again, good reviews. But this country is kind of slow to let in the reality of climate change. And as a result, we're delaying solutions so long that we're entering a period of consequences, serious consequences. And that's, I think, what we've seen with Hurricane Sandy. You know, we all hope that we can respond fast enough and get off of carbon fuels fast enough this century to prevent the worst impacts of global warming. But you have to wonder, what is it going to take? And is it going to take Katrina 2, 3, and 4 and Sandy 5, 6, and 7? I don't know. I hope not.
Well, in a recent press conference, you explained a new concept that everybody needs to grasp after Hurricane Sandy, and I'm talking about that continual line in scientific circles and echoed by the press that says you can never blame a single storm like Sandy on climate change. What do you say to that?
Well, the real answer to that question, did global warming cause Sandy? The real answer is yes, absolutely. And how can someone say with certainty that global warming caused Sandy when we've been told over and over again that you can't tie any single weather event to global warming? The reason you can say with certainty that global warming caused Sandy is because we've changed the great ecological systems of this planet. Nobody can deny that we are already seeing sea level rise. We've had about a foot of sea level rise worldwide in the last 100 years, attributed almost entirely to global warming. When you melt the land-based glaciers, the oceans rise. When you heat the oceans in terms of temperature, the water expands. And those two factors together cause sea level rise. So we know sea level rise is happening. There's no controversy there. You can measure it. It is a fact. We also know that we've increased moisture in the atmosphere because of global warming. The warmer the planet is, the more evaporation occurs over oceans and the more moisture is in the atmosphere. So that's number two. We know there's been a 5% increase in moisture in the global atmosphere just since the 1970s. And then on top of that, we know we've raised the sea surface temperatures of the world's oceans, including the Atlantic Ocean. Those are all not disputable. Those are facts. More moisture, you can measure it, higher ocean temperatures, and more sea level rise. So we've systemically changed the planet already. And systemically, those are the main drivers of Hurricane Sandy: warm water, sea level rise, and more moisture in the atmosphere. So systemically, we clearly made Sandy the monster that she was because we've changed these systems. And when you look at it from that perspective, in terms of systemic causation, then it's clear that the fingerprints of climate change are all over this hurricane, undeniably.
Mike, do you know where that concept of systemic causation came from? And who started that out?
Well, I first learned it actually about a week ago from the great linguist George Lakoff. Yeah. He first, I saw an email that he sent out to everyone making the same argument that I just made of systemic causation. And I think it's undeniable. It's irrefutable. It's the way that we need to start talking about climate change in terms of individual extreme weather events.
Well, look, maybe Fox News and Mitt Romney don't believe in climate change, or at least last week Mitt didn't, but insurance companies sure do. Tell us about that.
The insurance companies are not Republican corporations. They're not Democratic corporations. They're corporations, and they have their private capital at risk. And that's where, if you really want to know what's really happening and what the real truth on climate change is, just watch the private insurance companies. They are warning that extreme weather is increasing and that climate change is happening. Why are they warning? Because they're affected by it. They're harmed by it. Travelers Insurance just a month ago sent me, I have Travelers Insurance Company for my own homeowner's policy here in Montgomery County, Maryland. And Travelers sent me a notice just a month ago with a color flyer illustration of a two-story home with a garage, sort of all-American Main Street home. And that home is in the same illustration from my friendly insurance company, the Red Umbrella People. There is a tornado in the illustration about to hit the home. There are dark storm clouds over the home. And this illustration had the facts on it from Travelers. It said extreme weather events are increasing in the United States, and as a result, the cost of insurance is going up. Now, this was not mailed to me by Al Gore. Again, it wasn't mailed to me by Greenpeace. It was mailed to me by Travelers Insurance Company. And at the very bottom, it said, what is the source of our information? And they note scientific information. They note information from the international reinsurance company, Munich Re, highly respected, all saying that extreme weather events are going up because of global climate change linked to the combustion of fossil fuels. So that's Travelers Insurance. Also in my state of Maryland, Allstate Insurance announced in 2006 that it would no longer issue new homeowners policies in the 11 easternmost counties of Maryland. Why? Because according to Allstate, Atlantic storms are getting bigger and sea level is rising, and as a result, they are retreating from many coastal markets in the mid-Atlantic. Again, these are real companies making real bottom-line decisions, and you know it should be a matter of concern to us because climate change ultimately will make the insurance virtually impossible. Insurers have to have predictable outcomes. They have to be able to measure the future based on what they've seen in the past in order to set premium rates and gauge their risk. If they can no longer gauge their risk, we can't have insurance, and without insurance, you can't have a modern Western economy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Mike Tidwell, director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of the book The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. Well, Mike, talking about the coming death of America's coastal cities is pretty provocative. Is there really a possibility we'll have to abandon some coastal cities?
Well, you know, my publisher, Free Press, came up with that depressing title, The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. You know, most people want to reach for the razor blades when they hear that title. But the intent of the publisher was to really try to shock readers into understanding that these are the kind of things that will happen unless we take action. If we do take action to switch to clean, renewable energy as fast as we can, our leading climate scientists worldwide say that we can probably avoid the worst impacts of global climate change. And by worst impacts, I mean, you know, not just 1 or 2 or 3 feet of sea level rise, but up to 30 feet of sea level rise if the Greenland ice sheet disappears. We can't adapt to that. We would have to abandon coastal cities if we got 30 feet of sea level rise by the end of this century. The worst impacts also include just the kind of catastrophic droughts on a regular scale that we've seen in North America this past year, the kind of growing size of storms and all these impacts together. That's what a world of 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees more warming. We can't go there. We do have to do some adaptation. I mean, we have some more warming in the bank no matter what we do, because carbon dioxide lingers in the atmosphere for up to a century after you release it from the combustion of fossil fuels. So there's a momentum toward more warming and more ocean rise no matter what we do, but it's still more in the adaptable range. And so what we need to do is start to adapt to the warming we can't prevent, and we need to prevent the warming that we can't adapt to. You know, 1 or 2 more degrees of warming, we're going to have to build floodgates for New York City. We're going to have to build levees for many of our coastal cities. But there's a reasonable chance that we can still inhabit these coastal areas. However, if we get to 3 or 4 or 5 degrees of warming and the Greenland ice sheet disappears, then we will see the death of most of our coastal cities just because they won't be habitable. You're not going to be able to live in areas that are perpetually in flood state, perpetually pelted by rain and threatened by high winds. And so it is a very real threat. I think that Hurricane Sandy is a curtain raiser. I think that Mayor Michael Bloomberg had it right this past week when he said, we have old infrastructure in New York, and we have a new reality in terms of weather. And what he meant by that was, one, we have to confront climate change. We have to acknowledge that it's real. It's one of the reasons Michael Bloomberg gave for endorsing President Obama for the presidency. And we also, the mayor is realistic to acknowledge, need to adapt to much of it as well. And that's a scary new world that we're entering. You know, the idea of major floodgates for New York City and levees in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, sort of the New Orleansization of many of our coastal cities, you know, sort of committing to the New Orleans model of living below sea level behind levees, is a scary prospect, but one that we're going to have to embrace at some level to adapt to the global warming that's already happening.
Boy, we're in a tough spot because the governments are already going broke and the energy companies have never made more money. Exxon and Chevron made more money than in the history of money. And they're pouring it all into political donations with Citizens United and so on. So I'm wondering, do you think Sandy could break the current deadlock in America where politicians won't even talk about global warming or not?
You know, I think, Alex, that we're reaching a point where the pain of storms like Sandy, the damage caused by the June 2012 derecho storm that caused so much damage and across much of the United States, the frequency of these new superstorms will very soon, it's my prediction, lead companies like Allstate Insurance Company and Travelers Insurance Company to begin pointing to ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal and these major insurance companies saying to ExxonMobil, your company is putting my company out of business. And I think that when you have major, you know, mainstream corporations like the insurers pointing to the oil companies and saying, you're putting us out of business with your dirty energy, then the political center of gravity really shifts in this country. And I think that that's where we're headed. Now, many of the insurers, ironically and tragically, are hesitant to say that the fossil fuel companies are causing global warming. They're quick now to acknowledge that global warming is happening, the insurers are. They're quick to acknowledge that there's more extreme weather because that's how they have to justify increasing their premiums. But they're slow to talk about oil and coal as a source. Why? Why would insurers be hesitant to talk about the source of the harm to their industry? It's because insurers don't make most of their money from the premiums they charge us. That's not how they make their money. They make their money by investing our premiums into the stock market. They invest those premiums, and that's how they make most of their money. And most of the insurance companies now are investing heavily, like many average Americans and Canadians, in ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel companies. So they're hesitant to say that oil and coal is causing climate change because they're afraid that these corporations somehow will be damaged and it will reduce the investment values that the insurance companies get. So it's a tragic sort of linkage that ultimately is dooming the very existence of these same insurance companies. They're going to have to break that sort of conspiracy of silence so soon because it's really an existential issue for the major insurers.
Well, and hopefully the people of America, the people who are getting washed out and having such severe damage and always having to clean up and rebuild and losing their homes and even losing their loved ones, they're going to put some pressure on the politicians and say, look, this is really happening. Do something.
I think you're seeing more of that. I think that, you know, having the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, mention climate change repeatedly in the aftermath of Sandy, the mayor of New York City, a political independent, mentioning climate change, you know, as a core problem. You had the Bloomberg Business Week magazine on its cover this week. It said in very large letters, it's global warming stupid, playing on the Bill Clinton phrase in early 90s of it's the economy stupid. And the executive editor of Bloomberg Business Week tweeted out this week that magazine cover about global warming is only controversial to stupid people. To people who are informed and paying attention, there's no controversy. We see it outside our front door. We see it every day. We see it monthly as the power continues to go out. And I think that polling in the United States shows that more and more Americans are noticing extreme weather, are linking it to climate change, and more want something to be done about it. But the big challenge, again, is going up against the money, the oceans of money, as you mentioned, of ExxonMobil and the natural gas companies pouring it into our political system, you know, buying off, you know, buying the silence of many politicians. But there just comes a point where it just can't be ignored politically any further.
Mike Tidwell, how can people find out more about you, your books, and the Chesapeake Climate Action Network?
Well, listeners can go to ChesapeakeClimate.org. That's ChesapeakeClimate.org. And you can find all the information about what my group is doing in the Mid-Atlantic to champion clean energy solutions and raise awareness about climate change, not just on the East Coast of the United States, but across America and across the world. And also, you can see my writings. You can find all my writings there, including my book, The Ravaging Tide, which is there to read for free online. And that's where you go, ChesapeakeClimate.org.
We've been talking with author, filmmaker, and environmental leader Mike Tidwell. And thank you so much for joining us on such short notice, Mike.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Could New York have been saved from the storm surge of Hurricane Sandy? Can we protect other cities like Washington, D.C. or Baltimore? What about the rest of near-coastal residents? Joining us now is Professor J. Cort Stevenson from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science in Cambridge, Maryland. Professor Stevenson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
The devastation in New York State and New Jersey from Hurricane Sandy was shocking, but would you say it was predictable?
Well, in the long term it is, but in the short term, I think it came as a shock to me. I actually grew up around New York Harbor. My dad had a boatyard on Staten Island, which actually you're probably seeing in the news right now. We encountered several hurricanes during the course of my younger days when I was there, and each one was terrifying in its own way. But I never really would have expected that the subway system would have been disabled in such a drastic way. And I was really surprised by the Hoboken flooding, too. So in the abstract, yes, I was really thinking that this could happen, but when it actually is here, it's shocking.
Well, I think I'm in the same boat there, and so are a lot of people. You know, on Radio EcoShock, we interview a lot of scientists and activists saying we have to cut emissions, and so far it hasn't worked. Now we have to look at adapting to extreme climate events while we cut greenhouse gas emissions. What could New York do to prevent more catastrophes like Sandy, do you think?
Well, I know that Mayor Bloomberg had convened, I think he called it a subcommittee, several years ago, even it's they started. So it's been a question for a while whether New York Harbor could be protected from surges like the one we got from Sandy. The problem with New York Harbor is right now there's three entrances. One is at Hell Gate, which is actually comes off of Long Island Sound. The main one is in the Narrows. Narrows goes between Brooklyn and Staten Island. And that's the main passage that the big ships come into the harbor. The other one is a smaller passage, but nonetheless important because of the tanker traffic. It's the Kill Van Cull. So you'd have to really stop up those three passages. So that gets pretty complicated rather quickly. I'm sure that the committee is looking at other options, too. There's one that is even more encompassing, which would actually be one long barrier from Sandy Hook going north to the Rockaways, and you'd have to have a major opening there that would be convertible up and down or depending on how you wanted to do it. But at they call it the Ambrose Channel. It's the big channel that goes in and out of New York Harbor. So it is doable to really prevent a surge, I think. And definitely the mayor, I think, is probably looking at those options more carefully right now. The problem is it takes a lot of money, and it also takes a lot of patience and community will to do that. And I think something like this really starts to get people wound up. I've been on committees before where we start going ahead, but when the price tag goes up, people get very, very anxious. Of course, $10 billion sounds like a huge amount of money, and it is. It's about the same amount that we took to build the Boston Big Dig project, so it's not a trifle. But these projects, even though they can amount to that level, can probably save themselves on one big storm like this.
Yeah, and we may have some saving in human lives, too. That's another big point. Could you tell us about surge protection devices installed in other parts of the world?
You know, when you travel through Europe, you know, you see these, well, the big project that most of us know about is in the Netherlands. I mean, there they've put polders or, you know, barriers against the sea up for miles. And then across the Scheldt River in the southwest of the Netherlands, they've got a series of barriers. Actually, there's quite a few of them. If you really want to go to study this thing, it requires kind of a massive undertaking because there's just so much going on in the Netherlands. But there's another big project in Italy. It's for Venice, and the Venice Lagoon, it actually has three major outlets to the sea, and they're really going to put basically barriers that come off of the bottom. In other words, they're hinged, and they pop up when you pump air into them. They just pop off the bottom, and they're built to withstand a pretty good surge there. Venice has had flooding for, well, a good 50 or 60 years that's been problematic. It's occurring because you have special winds that come down from the north and start to interact with the tidal dynamics to give you a surge in the upper Adriatic.
Radio EcoShock will be back in just a minute with more ways to protect our cities from storm surges with Maryland professor J. Court Stevenson.